Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Be sure to check. Woo?
I'm sorry.
Did you get that woo in there?
I did get that woo. That's the very beginning of the podcast. So this will be a high energy episode. Speaking of high energy, our most recent podcast is about Anomalisa, so you can check that out at MacGuffinMan.com. And another high energy movie, Spotlight, was the thing we talked about before. But yeah, and also follow us on Twitter. And that's about it. I'll be posting something that I wrote about Sia and pop punk, pop punk, the new Spotlight. That'll be up whenever I decide it's done. So yeah, check out our website, themacguffinman.com. Tell your friends, subscribe to us on iTunes, and that's it. Theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
A podcast 8 years or maybe like a year and a half in the making, depending on whose word you take.
But we've been teasing this one with mysterious teasers for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's finally happening.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're talking about Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of surprised we hadn't done Cloverfield on its own yet.
I mean, we might have talked about it during the last Planet of the Apes movie podcast that we did. So Dawn of the Planet, I forget those. Rise of the Planet, there it is. Because Matt Reeves directed it. That's why I said that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I thought J.J. Abrams directed all these movies. we'll get there.
Yeah. Michelle Trachtenberg directed the second one. Harriet the Spy herself.
Dan. Okay, serious time.
Also no relation.
yes, we both saw Cloverfield in theaters and I'm sure discussed it among each other, but didn't hit the record button. Mm-hmm.
because this is a couple years before our podcast even existed.
True. 2008 is Cloverfield.
January 2008. You are correct.
January 2008. Just snuck in.
Brett Favre was still a Green Bay Packer.
Okay. I thought
Patriots were undefeated. No, I left Brett Favre's last game as a Packer while it was in overtime to go see this movie. That's why I remember that.
Okay. Okay, the rest of this will be about Cloverfield Lane. and it was, I mean, it was an interesting movie at the time, and it was mostly because the cinematography, it was much discussed. I mean, there was also the fact that a lot of people just enjoyed it a lot, but it was one of those ones that I found got talked about more than other movies that just as many people saw because of that feature, correct?
Yeah, and I think the trailer had a huge part to do with it. Like, the teaser trailer for this movie is, like, all-time good, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I think it's so good.
Yeah, and that's a huge part of it as well, that, yeah, you're correct. It was a very just kind of mysterious campaign. It was kind of one of the first ones that really took advantage of a lot of the, trying to go viral or having viral tie-ins and having these kind of ancillary stories and digital texts online to kind of get people more interested in it. It was
like all the characters had MySpace pages.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just an interesting way to do it. And as you said, that initial trailer, when this movie went under a few different names in its production and, you know, even during its marketing went through a couple different names. And I think the trailer you're describing is the one that didn't even have a title with it, correct?
That is correct.
Which is so interesting to me, right?
Yeah, it's just like from producer J.J. Abrams and then a date. And then the shot of the horse. It's the Statue of Liberty that closes it, I think.
Yeah. And this was, I mean, unprecedented. They had to ask the MPAA if we can run a trailer and not say what it's advertising because no one had really wanted to do that before. But that's just, I think a very interesting way. I mean, it's a teaser trailer. What a great way to tease something than you not even knowing what it is you're being teased about. So
yeah, yeah.
That's interesting to me. And, you know, we talked about the MySpace page and things like that. And these are things that are so pedestrian now, you know, to have all these like for a movie to have a website or to have a kind of a cryptic website even.
Yeah, exactly. No, by this point, having a website was borderline passe, and this is kind of like very, very near the beginning of all of these things where the social media campaign is talked about with the green lighting of the movie. Like The Dark Knight came out in 2008 as well and had a very sort of viral marketing sort of vibe to it.
Yeah. Well. So it's just around that time that this is pretty cutting edge. And J.J. Abrams, you know, I still feel he kind of has this youthful energy and kind of aura to him.
Well, because, he looks and has the haircut of a small child, you know?
That's true. But, I mean, the fact that I still kind of think of him that way now subtract nearly a decade. And so there's still that. And, you know, as we said about the marketing, very cutting edge. And the use of found footage, I mean, it had been done years before with the Blair Witch Project to much commercial success.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that movie's another trailblazer as far as the marketing aspect of a movie, because like when that movie came out, people didn't know if it was real or fake.
Yeah, you know? And I remember people being surprised when one of the dead characters was on Jay Leno.
Yeah.
That was something I remember people really struggling with. And I don't mean that, you know, to sound more intelligent. There was a time where I think I must have been under the impression that this was real. I mean, I'm guessing that was probably the case.
I've still never seen the movie, but I assume if I had seen it in theaters, I would have 100% thought it was real because I was 14. I would
have. Yes. And so this was, I mean, it just kind of was an interesting movie in a lot of ways. The marketing, J.J. Abrams kind of still very much being new on the scene. I mean, having worked in entertainment for a long time, but just his notoriety increasing constantly, right?
Yeah, well, and this is coming out at the peak of Lost. I believe the third season of Lost is on the air when this movie comes out. And so it hadn't lost all of its luster yet.
right.
And not that I ever watched Lost. This is not me. This is me talking about how people responded to it, the people I know that watch it.
This is the pre-Smoke Monster era of Lost, which in my understanding is the good era.
I feel like the Smoke Monster happened pretty early. Like the season three is when it's we have to go back. Like when they start doing the flash forwards stuff, I think.
Well, people who haven't seen Lost talking about Lost, we should probably move on.
Yeah, no, anyway, just what I'm saying is that, but that was a show that was specifically built around mystery, you know, and it was the thing he was the most famous for, and he was really, with the Cloverfield production, they were really leaning into that whole mysteriousness, you know, and with the way that they had promoted Lost as well in previous seasons where, you know, teasing the season one audience with stuff about season two that was extremely cryptic and getting people to think ahead about that. You know, I think that was kind of the testing ground for what eventually became how Bad Robot and Company wanted to market Cloverfield.
Yeah. And there was a TED Talk that J.J. Abrams did around the time that, he would have been working on Cloverfield it must have been almost complete at that time, which is all about mystery and how important mystery is to him, and talking about things like, you know, the Jaws shark, you know, Bruce not working on the set of it at the time, creating all this mystery around it. And that's, you know, not seeing the monster is what made that movie so powerful. And just that notion of mystery is a definite through line throughout his work. And it's just becomes more and more prominent as he kind of gains more power and is able to control things a little bit better.
So
interesting, you know, marketing, as we said, you know, trailer without even having its name, and again even the ones after it kind of just really shrouded in mystery the nature of what we were going to see. And yeah, as I said, the found footage thing had been done, but not, you know, too often, and this was just a very big example of it being done with a bit more money for once.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And something about, you know, just keeping the mystery to it, along with the kind of the short teaser trailers and these kind of cryptic forms of marketing online, when auditioning people, they had them read scripts from Lost and Alias or things written just for this audition, just to keep lines and story facts about this narrative still in the dark. And I'd never heard that before, and I found that very interesting.
Yeah, and didn't Lizzie Kaplan say she had no idea what the movie was until she was shooting it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's one thing about this movie that I mean, you probably know these actors better than I do, but I love how most of them are relatively unknown, or at least 10 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
And a lot of them haven't had huge careers. I mean, I looked over their IMDb pages. T.J. Miller's doing very well, but a lot of these people, they've continued to work, just mm-hmm. not, you know, never kind of got to be the A-list star whose face you'd recognize everywhere. And I think that really helps this movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I knew a number of people from other things when this movie came out. Lizzie Kaplan especially was the one that stood out.
Well, that's the thing watching it now. I still don't know the other people that well other than Lizzie Kaplan and T.J. Miller. Mm-hmm. And Lizzie Kaplan kind of has this attitude like she is famous. You know how mm-hmm. she kind of acts a little bit better than everybody, and everyone's kind of wasting her time in this movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, Beth doesn't have much of a career. She was in a couple other horror movies. And Jessica Lucas, I remember she was in She's the Man, and her boyfriend was in Skate. So, I mean, that's kind of like they were both supporting characters in those movies. Or sorry, not Skate, Grind. There it is. Mixed up video games and movies. So, I mean, these are not prominent roles, and I certainly had no idea who T.J. Miller was at the time.
Yeah.
And Rob wasn't really in anything and isn't in much now. Still, he was in Show Me a Hero, but... that's good. I mean, that's far by and large the most interesting thing he's been in since Cloverfield.
Yeah, and I just think that really works. I mean, the whole found footage angle, the you know, just the, again, with the way that they marketed it, that this was something that like these MySpace pages and things mm-hmm. like that. I really found watching it again, not being distracted by who these people were and their other roles for the most part, except for the people we discussed
in
detail. I thought that was really helpful. And I think just the nature of the way that this movie was put together, that really helped it.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you feel about it watching it more recently? Because I hadn't seen it in a long time.
Yeah. Loved it when it came out. Still really like it. I think it's a very, very effective action movie. And, it's also, I mean, it's so short and it's just really well put together, you know, like I just, it's hard to not enjoy this movie to me, you know. I think it's a really, really good example of just a short to the point sort of genre movie. You know? Like, yeah. I wish there was a movie that was like Cloverfield once a year, not necessarily a monster movie, but just a movie that was like, you know, a tight 85 minutes of just a really well put together simple story.
Not trying to really overreach, but doing what it modestly tries to do very well. And how much of that do you think is the found footage?
It helps a lot, but even in the realm of found footage, like that was something that I tried to watch for a lot in preparation for this, was to look at the staging and stuff. And for a found footage movie, like the staging is much more complex than what you've come to expect, you know,
because also,
like, just in that there are multiple layers of things going on. Like, I remember there's one part where they first get to the street, I think after the Statue of Liberty head rolled and all that, where T.J. Miller is talking to Rob and he sees people over his shoulder looting the electronics store, and then the focus of the shot becomes that electronics store. He zooms in on them and then zooms back out and comes back to Rob. And there are also parts where when the military comes into play that are much more impressive as well, just because there are so many more moving pieces. I find that with a lot of found footage movies, they're doing it partially to cover up the fact that they don't have a budget, and so there are fewer moving pieces in like in the set, so that's why they have to move the camera more, you know.
Okay. And yeah. So but you feel that this it's still impressive in the amount of kind of like just the complicated blocking and the
exactly.
choreography
and
that
just,
would be required.
Yeah, there are so many extras in a number of the scenes, and I especially really like the scene in the mall when they sort of, or wherever, is it Bloomingdale's that they find themselves in? Whatever department store that they're in, where the military descends on them, and then it's sort of like...
Oh, yeah, right.
All that stuff I thought was really, really good, because there's a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, and I saw that T.J. Miller said he filmed about a third of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you think that kind of the construction of it is impressive in the camera work, or do you think it was just so well put together around him that he could kind of just film naturally and that would... like a good product would show up?
Yeah, I think the camera work kind of covers up a lot of the edges, I guess. Like, it's sort of, when it's so shaky, you just miss certain things that might have been missed on set, like that they couldn't cover up. So you just still don't see it. But I think it's a little bit of both, you know, like the staging definitely matters. And I think a lot of the scenes that T.J. Miller filmed are not the scenes that I found the most impressive, you know, just by looking at, you know, what I looked at the cameras that they used. And you can really tell in this movie when they're using a cheaper camera. And those are
like the party scenes and things like that.
Party. Actually, there's a lot of stuff on the party that I don't think was shot on a super cheap camera. The one that's really coming to mind is right towards the end when they're running to go under the bridge, Rob and Beth. Like that. Anytime you see a lot of like that blue green that just looks really kind of gross, it's definitely a cheaper camera. And I think actually, you know what? I think the department store stuff, there was a lot of the cheaper camera as well. But so maybe I'm wrong. Yeah,
okay.
I don't know what I'm saying.
Okay, cool. I'll talk then.
Par for the course.
So did you find it ever kind of problematic that, I mean, and this is, to be upfront, this is a thing that I really found myself getting stuck on a lot.
Yeah. Did you like this movie before we get to this?
Oh, less than I thought I would. Less than I hoped to. I mean, I really liked it in theaters, and I have clear memories of defending it to people who were like, oh, shaky cam. No, shut up. Just
yeah,
stop.
People are idiots.
Yeah, I liked it a little bit less, and I think a lot of it is what I'm about to describe. So just that the things that aren't on the camera, like within frame, don't exist until we see it, you know, like this is a massive monster. You should be able to follow this thing on sound. You should be able to follow this thing on a seismograph. And I mean, especially Hud's death, where it was right behind him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, I mean, anyone who's listened to this podcast regularly knows I'm not the very nitpicky about that kind of stuff. And I don't get caught up in the plot hole kind of debates some people seem to really enjoy doing. But I found that like really problematic at times about this gigantic thing sneaking up on them and, you know, jumping to their helicopter and things like that. I thought it was just too much, like really took me out of it as someone who doesn't get taken out of it by that kind of thing. And it just made it feel like a ride at Wonderland or something. You know what I mean? Like those ones where the chairs move. It just, you know what I mean, though?
I've never been to Wonderland, but I can imagine.
Okay.
Unsurprisingly, yeah. I hate rides.
Yeah, really. It was a little bit cheap to me. And I think that, just too much of that really took me away at some key points. And I think, you know, the thing about a found footage thing and the thing about this kind of, you know, cast of unknowns and doing, you know, telling a story from one person's perspective is that I think one of the great things about that is we often get away from that kind of silly storytelling like that. And the number of times that popped up was frustrating for me.
See, I kind of like, I don't have that problem at all. And I think it's just because, I mean, this is a disaster movie from just sort of a new perspective. Like the found footage is being applied to a Godzilla / disaster movie, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've never seen a disaster movie that wasn't absurd, you know, like where the focus is on the disaster or the monster and it's not absurd. So I guess I just didn't care because I knew that there was going to be a monster involved. So I assumed that there will be plenty of these, you know what, just fuck it, we'll scare them, you know, we'll break our rules, but we'll scare them, you know? So that doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I guess for me, there's that kind of movie, and then this is, I understand it's still very much within the genre of, or the subgenre of disaster movies, To me, it just seemed like everything else about this says that it should avoid those kinds of things, and it doesn't. And I know that, you know, maybe I'd find this movie so boring if it were more realistic, but...
Yeah, this movie's more realistic. It's about 25 minutes long.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily true, though.
It's not, but it's certainly much more likely that HUD turns off the camera pretty fucking quick.
Right. Yeah, and so, I mean, that kind of stuff, too. The way that it's presented is this is a tape, and I mean, this is something I'm paraphrasing from an interview with the people responsible with making this. The way that they frame this with the intro saying this is a piece of government evidence, case designate, Cloverfield, do not duplicate, all that kind of stuff. You know, the idea is that we found this camera. We took out the SD card. I don't know. What did they do in 2008?
No, it would have been probably mini DV tape.
Okay, mini DV tape. You know, and press play. And that's why we have these moments where it doesn't look good. We have these moments where there's no... you know, military value to Rob and Beth fighting in the hallway, but we see it anyway. You know, and the footage of Rob and Beth, Coney Island, or in bed or whatever. To present it like that, for that to be the first thing, and then to have these times where turning on and off the camera wouldn't make sense, and there are these clear edits, or when they choose to rewatch something, goes to footage of Coney Island again. It doesn't make sense to me. And it's not a huge problem. And that's not my only issue with, you know, that's not, this movie's a 10, except for that brings it down to a 7 or something like that. But I found some of that stuff to be problematic just because they specifically frame it one way and then depart.
Well, I mean, the tape thing, like, or sorry, Coney Island thing where they jump back to Coney Island, because they were rewinding to look at the monster. That's because you have to rewind to look at the monster, and then you can't land precisely on where you stopped, you know, so they end a bit forward. So it's a couple seconds of Coney Island of what was on the tape underneath it before HUD was taping over the Coney Island footage, you know?
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. That's how tapes work.
What about mini DVs?
That's how mini DVs. Mini DV tapes are just small tapes.
Okay. Yeah.
That's how mini DV as a format works. And that's why, like, a year later, this movie doesn't work because things have switched over to digital pretty much entirely. Whereas at the time, tapes were still a thing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. More important question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of Garfield?
I am. I also enjoyed how, like, how insane that question is. Like, it's like Mickey Mouse and Superman are number one and two of the most known fictional characters in the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's good. I think she relates to Garfield, and that's why it's fresh in her memory.
Yeah. That's probably true.
Anything else on Cloverfield 1 before we move to...
I mean, we didn't really talk about, like, because the thing that I enjoy... from a thematic standpoint is just and it's something that they hit pretty hard. But it's just like, and I think it's HUD that says it to Rob when on the roof, after Beth and Rob have their fight in the hallway or whatever. Somebody says to Rob, forget the world and hang on to the people you care about the most. And that's the movie in a nutshell, right? We follow, or not the whole movie, but definitely the post-disaster part, or the mid-disaster part, whatever, because it's all about a quest to get Beth back, right? And like that's something that's present in pretty much every disaster movie, you know? Like San Andreas is the most recent one, and that is very much a good example of that. It involves divorced parents getting back together, all the wonderful things that you get in disaster movies, and it was awesome. But like I just felt that the way the movie did it with sort of admittedly accidental, but obviously since it's real, you know, like it's edited to put these places here, or these flashbacks to Coney Island and stuff here. I really enjoyed the way those things cut in, because it's sort of like it's giving you flashes of why you are doing all of this instead of just running away. And I thought that was really nice. And I really enjoy the very ending of the movie when they're just on a Ferris wheel or something like that. And the last line is, I think she says, I had a nice day, you know, and I like all of that stuff, because like, why are you going into the heart of this insanity? Because you had a nice day at Coney Island, and presumably there are many others that were not caught on camera, you know?
Yeah. So, and there's more nice days to be had with these people.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
you can take her off a piece of rebar and get her out of Manhattan.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Also the subway tunnel scene is amazing. And, I feel like that needs to be mentioned at some point.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. It's really good. I love the rats running away first.
Oh, that's so good.
Obviously a great start. And I mean, I wish we could have seen that flaming hobo, but yeah, no, that's really good. And I think that's one of the strongest parts, because it's, you know, it's a bit, I find a bit more reasonable too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's really good. And just the amount of darkness and when they're kind of forced to fight back and just doing it off the one flashlight, I think, yeah, it makes for a very affecting scene. And I think, yeah, that's definitely a strong part. I mean, I do like that they managed to cover so many kind of set pieces following this one group of people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Sometimes with a disaster movie, sometimes we just kind of split off from our main characters to mm-hmm. get kind of these money shots that we might not be able to work into their narrative. Mm-hmm. So I do think that's good. And that's definitely a good part. And I do like that scene in the electronic store when a lot of people are looting and he's just getting new battery and they're getting information from TV.
Yeah.
I think that's a really strong scene too. And just the lack of information we get. And I mean, that comes with the found footage kind of perspective of, you know, not following a character like Brad Pitt in World War Z, who's this really smart guy who would know about kinds of things, or, you know, Bryan Cranston in Godzilla, who, or, you know, anytime we kind of follow one of the experts who has these, I don't know why those were the two movies.
Bryan Cranston is a particularly bad example.
But yeah.
Okay. As a person that has seen the movie, he's not the best choice for that one.
Okay. I'm not going to talk about movies I haven't seen before. Make that a policy. Yeah, okay.
No, we talk about TV shows and movies that we haven't seen, like we've already seen them.
Yeah.
Until somebody calls us on.
But unless Alistair's seen it, we're in the clear.
Yeah, exactly.
This movie really gets me for a while at times, but then it just loses me for a bit. But overall, it's enjoyable. I mean, I liked watching it again, and I was kind of surprised by some of the things I did remember and some of the things I didn't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Also, you talked a lot about how they kind of fudge with the sort of found footage thing. This is something that they just do so well that nobody would ever think about it. But the sound in this movie is amazing. None of the theoretical cameras that TJ Miller is holding in this movie are very good on audio, you know?
And that's something I would let slide, even if it kind of was more apparent to me.
Okay, that's fair. But yeah, that was something that really jumped out to me about this movie, is how well done the sound is. And that's a subway tunnel sequence. The sound is so important. The sound those giant spiders make is just repulsive. And like, I was just even just watching it through right before this, I was kind of doing other things and just had it playing in the background. And I was just like, I don't like this. I don't like hearing this. You know, I wasn't even really watching the scene. You know, it was just, it's just really uncomfortable, and there's a lot of just really good use of sound in the movie. You know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
All right. So let's move on to 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Sure.
How first and most important question.
Yes.
How much more would you like this movie if it was just called like 2 Cloverfield Lane, and it would just like really confusingly put the sequel number in there?
This happens on Cloverfield Lane too.
Yeah. Or if they put like 8 movies in between the two, and this is this ends up being the 10th of the series, it's like a real Fast and Furious situation.
You know, I love me some titles.
We're
working our way
to Tokyo Drift.
I don't know if I would like it more that way.
No, I don't care about it. I didn't actually care.
I kind of like it a lot as it is, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it. I enjoy like small scale things. I enjoy people being trapped in places.
Bottle episodes.
I enjoyed the whole Unbreakable Michelle Schmidt vibe that permeated the movie.
Yeah, I know. Is this going to be like a new little trope that's going to be more popular?
I don't know. I feel like we've got to be at peak trapped in rooms right now, you know, like because Kimmy Schmidt was what, last April, and then Room, and now this.
And more Kimmy Schmidt in a month.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I feel like we can only count that once, and unless she's going back into the bunker, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, obviously, and I mean that's where so much of the strength of this movie comes from, is just those tense moments that you can do so well in you know, kind of the locked room scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the history of this one? It's an interesting one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the script was purchased. It was called The Cellar, you said, right?
Yeah.
The script was purchased by Bad Robot and did not involve monsters in any capacity as it was initially written. And then I forget the original writer's names, but I do not forget the person that did the rewrite, because it was Damien Chazelle, writer and director of Whiplash. And I was brought on to do a rewrite. And at some point during the production, Bad Robot decided that they could turn it into a Cloverfield movie, a quote unquote, according to J.J. Abrams, blood relative of Cloverfield.
Yeah. My understanding is that Damien Chazelle doesn't have a ton left in the final product of this movie.
Okay.
He left when Whiplash got funding.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a writer named Dan Casey who kind of did the last work on it that I think a lot of his work survives, is my understanding.
Okay, sure. I don't know that much about it.
Yeah.
But I know David Chazelle's on the credits, so I'm going to remember that. Anyway,
yes. Yeah, well, but I think that's so much off the strength of Whiplash is why his name is still kind of there. I think it would be different if Whiplash didn't do well, or as well as it did.
Hmm. Okay.
But yeah, Paramount Pictures bought it, and they have a little... a department called Insurge Pictures, which is their kind of low budget wing. And this movie was written with the intention of being a kind of low budget movie, like a lot of these, you know, one set movies are with three actors for the most part. And yeah, that's what happened, as far as I know, is that, J.J. Abrams, Bad Robot, saw a way to tie this into the Cloververse as as it is. And, I mean, people have... And so some minor things seem to be reworked in the script, and a different title given, and an ending. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, how long do you think that is?
That ending? Like, from when she gets out to the end of the movie?
Yeah.
10 minutes.
Yeah, it's last and it's so big that it sticks with you. But I kind of had the feeling it's not a ton of time either.
Yeah, and the way things go with the way people remember movies is that, like, pretty much the way you remember every scene, like it's the way that it is in reality is actually shorter when you were to watch the movie and time it out. You know?
Okay.
Everybody remembers things being longer than they are.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and so there's a lot of people who have extremely different opinions on this idea of kind of what he did. And by him, I mean J.J. Abrams. And we'll talk more about kind of his involvement and his notoriety, I guess. but, you know, on the two ends of the spectrum, there's kind of the negative side where J.J. Abrams, who is seeing kind of the way things movies are going, that it's the franchises and the cinematic universes that are making all the money now. And this is someone who, you know, just directed a Star Wars movie.
he just directed the head of the cinematic universe.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're going to make, it seems like at least one of those are going to come out for you know, ever. Yeah. One of those can come out each year until I guess it stops making money. You know, and he did some Star Trek and Mission Impossible. So, the negative perception of this is that he kind of just wants to have a bigger piece of the pie. And he saw a script that he could buy for cheap and shoehorn a few references in and, you know, put on an ending and get a built-in audience and, you know, as I said, get a bigger piece of the pie, have another franchise that he can be a part of and have a ton of control over. And then there's the other side, which is that he saw a good, well-written script. He was clever enough to see its quality, kind of tinkered it with a bit just to make it fit in the reality that had kind of been established in Cloverfield, which, you know, isn't even the same world, it seems. And kind of build this cool anthology thing to kind of show that these things have quality and have similar DNA and things like that. And I wanted your opinion on which of those you find more valid or where on the spectrum you would fall or if any of those opinions don't even ring true to you at all.
I don't know. I guess I don't have strong opinions either way because
it seems you hate this franchise nonsense a lot.
But this is different from franchises, right? Because what this is doing is it's you know, relating the movie to a movie that previously existed. Ipso facto, it is a franchise, you know, but it's doing so in a way that is so totally different, right? The various cinematic universes that exist in our universe now are built on sort of being homogenous, you know. All the Marvel movies, even though they're like, oh, we pick real directors and all this stuff, they all still kind of look the same and feel the same, right? Whereas if you look at Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane back to back, the filmmaking style is totally different. The size of the movie is totally different. And there's not a lot relating the two movies.
Just a quick note about the size. I mean, in every other universe, it's about it getting bigger and bigger.
Exactly.
Whereas this one shrinks down.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And from that standpoint, it really is more, I believe you mentioned sort of the anthology vibe, but it really does feel like another piece of puzzle from a different perspective entirely, you know? It doesn't feel like... I mean, it feels like a movie that didn't have to be related to Cloverfield to be good. Right. Whereas I think you can see a lot of things that exist in the cinematic universes that exist that have to be tied into things that previously existed in order for them to be enjoyable. Yeah. You know? Like the thing that's enjoyable is the way that they build off all the other things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. Is it that's what makes them good or is that what gets them seen? Is their connection to these other things?
Like, oh, I'm just talking about quality. I don't care about whether or not they get seen. Yeah.
Okay.
This movie, 10 Cloverfield Lane, unquestionably makes more money because it is tied into the Cloverfield franchise, you know? That's 100% true.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I doubt there's anyone who does disagree, actually.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think the one thing that is definitely true about this movie, I think, if this movie were to be released without the name Cloverfield attached, I would have had big problems with the monster showing up at the end, right? Whereas, as it exists now, it's like you're kind of prepared for something like that, but you also still don't totally know where it's going, you know?
Yeah, so you would have how much of a problem would that be, that Howard was right and that there is something out there?
Not necessarily that Howard was right, it just... what he was right about, you know, like it's just so. If it had been like a, you know, there's a war going on outside or something, that would have been less problematic. Or sorry, a human versus human war going on outside would have been less problematic, you know. But like, I think the idea of monsters or aliens coming out of nowhere would have been too much for me to deal with.
Yeah,
and not like me just freaking out of my seat, but me being like,
he was right.
I'm building a bunker.
Yeah, and it's even knowing that I was going to see some aliens or monsters or some, you know, made up beast, it's still tough to get that so late in the movie. Just because you don't know what they're going to look like, and everything always kind of looks a little bit silly when you see it for the first time. If it's an alien, because it looks alien to you, it's just something you're not used to seeing, so it stands out. And yeah, I think kind of what you said about being prepared this whole way. There's a bit of that's CGI. How does this work? You kind of think about it a bit, but I found those scenes to be really good. You know,
yeah, they were pretty good. And one thing that was surprising about them, even though you're kind of half expecting them, or more than half expecting them to show up in the movie, is that it wasn't the monster that we know from Cloverfield, right? That was the thing that I found surprising when you first sort of get the looks at these things. It's just like, oh, you know, it's like it's a new thing. You know, I assumed that there would somehow be actually like the same monster from the end of Cloverfield tied in at some point, you know, and that was something that I found surprising and very much enjoyed. You know, it's still, she still fights a giant version and a tiny version, but yeah. You know, they look totally different.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. I thought that was cool. But yeah, I think those scenes in general were done well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of quickly jumped to the end there. And I think that another very strong thing about this movie is the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You just love Bradley Cooper.
I was going to say. You don't have to see his ugly face, though.
Yeah, exactly. It's so burnt.
I mean, I know I'm not the only one, but I thought that was just such an interesting, jarring way. I mean, she doesn't speak. And by the time the car crash and we get those smash cuts to the title cards in complete silence and then back to the, you know, really loud abrasive car crash sounds, I thought that set such a great way to set the tone for the film.
Yeah, and the music in this movie all the way through is stellar, and I think that's a point where it really helps, you know, because like you said, there's no dialogue for a good portion of the beginning of this movie. It's probably only like 2.5 minutes, but you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he speaks over the phone, Ben, yeah. But she doesn't speak. Yeah. Yeah. But did you like the kind of the cuts to silence and things like that?
I liked the one, and then when they came back to noise and then back to silence, I thought that was overdoing it. And
oh, really?
I have no explanation as to why. I think it's just, I think at that point it becomes, like, once you do it twice, it's a gimmick. When you do it once, it's surprising. Twice, it's a gimmick. Although, I guess I was surprised that they did it a second time. So, I don't know. It's something about, I don't know, cuts to black are tricky because, you know, that like action movies did this for a bit around 2010, 2011, where sometimes they would just cut to black to add in extra edits, like real quick cuts to black. The one that's coming to mind is because it's the Michael Bay movie that did this, is the Transformers 3. There are parts where they don't jump. They just cut to black and then come right back to the same thing. And it's just really weird. And excuse me, it always kind of rubs me the wrong way. And I love a good cut to black and a harsh sound cut off, but the coming back feels weird.
You should have picked a movie you hadn't seen. yeah, I really like it. Agree to disagree. I think part of it for me is that it kind of gives us what this movie is. This movie is, you know, slow and quiet and then intense and wild and, you know, heart pounding and then a lull, not in a negative sense, but just in a less frantic sense. And, you know, everything's okay, and then she smashes a bottle on Howard's face and makes a run for it, and then she's back in the room. You know, I think that just the way that it ended up playing out throughout the movie is what helped me enjoy it, I think, in retrospect.
Okay.
Speaking of Howard, is John Goodman just so fantastic in this, or is that just me? In general?
I think he's good. I don't think he's necessarily fantastic, you know?
Oh, no?
No. There's nothing about him that I was just like, this is a game changer to me, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're already on board.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We're all on board the John Goodman.
Okay, good. Yeah. Good, good, good.
Except for Kristen Wiig, apparently.
I missed that one.
Oh, he said he will never talk to Kristen Wiig ever again because he once went up to her at a party and she asked him to wait for him to finish her conversation that was already ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Moving on.
Yeah.
So what did you like about this movie then? If you hated John Goodman and you
hate John Goodman, thing, for me to really love a performance, I don't know, there has to be something really, really special about it, you know? So it's not my beef with John Goodman. It's just,
I know.
Okay. Things I liked about, I mean, I just liked Michelle as a character. I don't know. She was so sharp all the time, and I like that about her. Yeah. You know, like she was very quick witted. You know, so yeah. In general, it's just sort of like the environment that is available to you for most of the movie when they're in the bunker, and you kind of know the limits that the character is actually dealing with. I mean, we talk about this a lot in whenever we talk about an action movie, the geography of the action matters so much, and setting up the geography that the action will take place in matters a lot. And this movie is like 80 minutes of geography setup, you know, like,
yeah.
So yeah, I think it's, I thought it was well done from that perspective. Yeah.
And yeah. And so similar to some of the issues that I had with Cloverfield, I guess I had some issues in this movie, which I think I stated already, but I did enjoy a lot. In just kind of the way that it was structured to maintain tension in the way that it would go down if anything like this happened.
Mm-hmm.
I know Howard is an odd duck, to put it delicately, but he's not stupid. And I think that in his way, he did want to... it just feels weird defending him at all, but like, protect Michelle and make her happy, and obviously in a very twisted, illogical way. I'm not saying this is how people should act, but it seems as though his goal was to make a family with her, as his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think initially, once she shows up and she's chained to a wall and you're in a bunker and there's this guy, it seems very rape and sexuality is what comes to mind. And I think that's kind of where her mind went, where a lot of women's minds would go, for a lot of historical evidence to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like he wants her to be happy, right? In his ideal world, she says, "Thank you for saving me. Let's, you know, I'm very grateful to you. Let's live together down here in happiness," right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In his ideal world, yes.
Yes, his that's what I'm saying. In his ideal world, this is kind of how I imagine this would play out. And I just feel like the way that, you know, "What are you going to do to me? I'm going to keep you alive," and then close the door. Would there be a kind of a nice discussion about, okay, I'm sorry that you've lost everyone in your life, and this is what I think happened. And I mean, that all that kind of stuff gets kind of doled out over what can assume is days and weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this movie loses me a bit. I think that it kind of cheats in a lot of the tension that it gets by having him and his motives be mysterious, when I would imagine he would want to be a little more upfront about that to put her at ease, because her happiness would be important to him in his twisted way that I'm in no way trying to defend.
Yeah. Yeah, they cheat. Also, it's a horror movie, you know, like, it's the same. My response is the same thing as it is in Cloverfield. Like, you are right, and I don't care. You know,
yeah.
It just doesn't. These things don't bother me, especially knowing that the movie that I was going in for. You know,
yeah, yeah. And I think generally these things aren't the kind of things that bother me. But I think it's, I don't know. I find some of it just to be a little disingenuous.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. good. I did kind of enjoy the different angle, I mean, of him kind of developing this family. And we see this when he can't think of Michelle as a woman when they're playing charades or whatever that game was. and things like that. And there's just nothing sexual about her. He wants to just braid her hair and raise her as a daughter, at least.
It's Emmett that knows how to braid hair.
Okay.
Yeah. But other than that, your point is correct. Yeah.
Or am I misreading this? And is there something with the with Megan or Brittany or any of these missing girls that says that that is not what he believes is, or that's not what he wants?
Well, I think it might be that the idea is that what he wants is just have this little small family in a bunker with Michelle. But I think the implication is that that will not last, you know, like that something will happen. And as you said, to put it mildly, Walter is an odd duck. And just in general, even if this person, people previous to Michelle or people, I guess there is no post Michelle given what happens to Walter, but,
Howard,
God damn it. Sorry. I keep calling him as a Big Lebowski name.
That happens when you find a stranger in the Alps.
Yeah, exactly. But like, is that you just can't trust this person to not do something horrible, you know, like, and, again, yeah. I know you are not arguing a post Howard or sorry, pro Howard stance,
yes,
but,
okay.
Nothing about him makes you feel like you are safe forever down here with him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And even if you were not killed, it's, you know, forcible confinement and, you know, just all these other horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Things.
I mean, we do not need to run down the list of reasons why Howard Walter is wrong.
Yeah. Howard Walter.
Did we get his last name? Let's just roll with it. Howard Walters. There it is. Nailed it.
Kowalski. I don't know. Okay. And what did you... Okay, I guess, and still onto that point, I suppose, is, you know, there's a history of him and another female cohabitant that, you know, in the pre-Michelle world, before a disaster. I mean, he says all these things about wanting to be prepared for the nuclear war or the mutant space worms or whatever it is that's going to bring about the apocalypse. But he also has this bunker for another reason, it seemed. And we have Emmett too, and we never, I still feel that there's a bit of mystery around Emmett. I mean, I feel like there's so many things that aren't explained in this movie, or that there could be several explanations for why Emmett's really there, what Howard's really doing, how they got there, how Michelle got to be there with them. Do you think Emmett is, I mean, do you think everything is on the surface with this? Like, do you think it's Emmett's telling the truth and Howard's the bad guy that, it seems he is. I mean, we know he's a bad guy, but in the way that it's described?
I think yes, because I don't have an answer otherwise. Like, I just don't have any other reasoning in my head for what Emmett does other than
right.
I believe what he said.
Yeah. And I'm not, again, in someone who's interested in fan theories and things like that, but I think that this movie to me is... something that is more interesting to me than the first Cloverfield, just because you could think about those things and there are things that aren't answered. I mean, we pretty much know what we need to know about Cloverfield, when I don't think that's the case at all in Cloverfield Lane.
Okay. I mean, I still don't know the story of the Cloverfield monster. I mean, you don't need to know it, but you can think about it.
Yeah.
I don't know the story of Beth and Rob's breakup. I don't particularly care. I don't know why Beth brought her new boyfriend to the party, but...
Travis, I know, right?
Oh, Travis. Nobody's ever met a good Travis.
How about the other game that they play with the Santa Claus? Did you like that moment?
Oh, it was so good. I love it.
I could see you hating that one as kind of being a little cheap, too.
No, that is one moment where the Goodman gravitas really, really worked for me.
Yeah, okay.
He nailed it. Because, like, if somebody plays that wrong, then that's so, so hacky. But the way it worked was great. And I feel like it was in line with Emmett's character as well. Had Michelle, like, popped in a frame, like, had been the Emmett close-up, and she, like, sticks her head in the way and was like, Santa Claus, then it's stupid. But... But that doesn't happen because this movie's made by a seemingly logical person.
So. Yes, a lot of intelligent people. Do you want to talk about J.J. Abrams' role in this? I mean, I think a lot of people are going to talk about J.J. Abrams like he directed this and wrote it, and the way that his name gets plastered on, you know, the gaffer on all of his movies, just because everyone talks that he just does everything. And that
gaffing brought to you by J.J. Abrams. Gaffing by whoever brought to you by J.J. Abrams.
Godfathered by.
Well, let's talk about the actual director first. We gave Matt Reeves a little love in Cloverfield, so let's give Mr. Trachtenberg some love as well. The filmmaking style, as we've talked about, is totally different. There is a handheld in Cloverfield Lane, but primarily right at the end. When she gets outside, it switches to a very handheld aesthetic. There's some static shots, but the closer she is to monsters, the more hectic, or the closer she is to fighting monsters, the more hectic the camera work is as she's working on her final escape with Walter. There's some handheld that she's running through the space and all that.
You said Walter again, by the
God
way.
God damn it. I don't know what it is.
I really do like those shots inside of her mask.
Yeah.
I think it often looks goofy when the camera's kind of fixed to something.
Mm-hmm. But the ones that are fixed inside of her mask, yeah.
Yeah, I thought those were really good, and more than I think more than I would imagine I would like them when written out on paper.
Yep, that's fair. Pretty much when they're in the bunker, the camera work is very controlled. The moves are on dolly tracks or on cranes or jibs of some sort. And that's just obviously totally different from the first Cloverfield. And I thought it was a well-shot movie, and there's that 360-degree pan shot as Michelle is introduced to the living room that I really enjoyed, where you can see the whole space. I thought that was really, really cool. It's very It Follows-y shot, and I like that.
But
it was just in general much more composed movie. So something about it felt like, I don't know, something about it felt like it didn't, there was something off about it to me, you know, and I don't know what it was. And I will preface this by saying, because you know how influenced I am by what I already think about directors, I did not know Damien Chazelle was the original, going to be the original director for this. I knew that he had his hands on the screenplay at some point, but I didn't know he was ever attached to direct, right? Mm-hmm.
Very curious about it. Go ahead.
Sorry?
I'd just be very curious about what it would look like if Whiplash didn't get
well. That's exactly it. Yeah. Like my point is, my love of Whiplash can't influence it. But Whiplash there's so much, so many interesting setups exist in Whiplash in such small spaces, and there are so many quick shots, just of the same space, but they all cut together really quickly. And because, you know, for some of the performance scenes, but I would have loved to see his version of 10 Cloverfield Lane, you know, because of that. But I couldn't think of this at the time. Anyway, it just felt like there was something about the vibe that didn't totally work. And did you think about the colors in this movie at all? Because you are our podcast resident color person.
I'm titles, colors. We're co on colors. You're so visual, though. So.
Yeah, but more normally camera related, not set related.
Yeah, it's true. It's sitcom-y to me.
Okay. Well, because behind her bed, behind Michelle's bed, the wall is green or greenish. You know, none of these colors are perfectly the color that I'm describing. And the opposing wall is sort of like halfway between pink and red. And then just outside, where we get the I'm Howard, by the way, nailed it.
Swish.
It's all blue, right? And so, like, I thought that was an interesting look in the wide shots. And given that Michelle moves from being green into the red, and then gets out past the blue at the end of the movie, obviously. It felt like there was something that they were trying to convey to me with that, that I could never really see, you know. And the scene where Emmett and Michelle have their backs to the wall, you know, and she's sitting on the pink side, he's sitting on the blue side, and they're having a conversation. There were interesting shots in there that, and then there were head-on shots of both of them, but it felt weird that the head-on shots never cut with the other head-on shots. I don't know. It always felt like there were generally good ideas, but never anything that really, really broke free of the mold of a pretty good movie, you know? Which is fine. This, to me, is a pretty good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, with the blue and the pinks, I just kind of thought that as them getting closer, like their masculinity and femininity coming out. And they're kind of both leaning on the wall as though they're leaning on each other. And I just took that as them getting closer. And I think that happens around the time where she touches his hand at the table in order to freak Howard out. Mm-hmm. And I just think she's, you know, she's an adult. She's an adult woman, not a little girl. And kind of having a connection with a male around her age, and that being unacceptable to Howard for reasons we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, the color palette wasn't I'll probably see this movie again, but and keep a closer eye on that. But I didn't get a ton from that. That's not to say it wasn't there, but maybe I just wasn't watching closely enough, or maybe it just wasn't there.
Yeah, I think my point is that it just felt so defined that there
should be a reason.
Yeah, exactly. Like it jumped out at me, and I was just like, oh, what's the reason behind this? And then I couldn't find one. You know, like I was looking. And typically when I see something in a movie, I'm like, there has to be a reason behind it. I can at least make one up, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah. But JJ.
JJ.
Yeah, you are right. And I mean, there's a lot of...
I'm right about what?
Everything. Yeah. The idea that J.J. Abrams gets so much credit for these movies that he doesn't direct. And I mean, just with what was going on in his life in 2007 and 2015, it's pretty easy to guess that he was probably more hands-on with the first Cloverfield.
Yeah.
And even aside from that, he is working with people that he's worked with for his whole career in the first movie. So even if he's offset for a day, he probably has a better read on what Matt Reeves is doing than what Dan Trachtenberg is doing, right? Just because they've had a long relationship at that point. So, yeah, I mean, I feel it's tricky, right? I feel weird about him getting all the credit for, especially Cloverfield, which I think is, again, a really well-put-together movie, when Matt Reeves actually directed it. But it's also... I mean, you also have to look at it as J.J. Abrams is also launching careers. You know, like Dan Trachtenberg has a career now, and Matt Reeves has a pretty good career because of J.J. Abrams as well.
This is Trachtenberg's first feature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm conflicted because the dream of a filmmaker is to make a film and have it be seen. Dan Trachtenberg could have made this film, you know, but J.J. Abrams got it seen. And yeah. He deserves credit for that, of course. It's just it feels like sometimes J.J. Abrams' name matters more as a producer than as a director. I mean, he produces everything he directs as well, so
yeah,
of course that plays into it. But
yeah, I think what it is I think he's just kind of a celebrity director. I think mm-hmm. his name I know his name is valuable now.
His name's been valuable for a long time.
Yeah, no, true. I think his name's kind of just become a bit of a shorthand for a certain kind of moviegoer and a certain kind of product. I think it ties into that marketing thing. I think people who are into looking at movies a little bit deeper and maybe checking out a website to answer questions, and if you get them right, you get a sonar image of the monster from Cloverfield before the movie comes out, which is a real thing. Mm-hmm.
Nerd.
I didn't do it.
So you say.
No, and I think you're right. I think, but from what I understand, and I'm so far from this, is that he generally seems to be a pretty nice guy from everything I've seen about him. I find in interviews he does mention people's names when people kind of gloss over their contributions.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think people kind of use his name as, or take his name as this blanket that they put over the whole project and don't give credit to the people who do other things. It takes a lot of people to make a movie. It takes someone to direct a movie, and that wasn't J.J. Abrams in this case, mm-hmm. or Cloverfield.
But he was the gaffer.
Right. Right. And I just think it's his name is so valuable that he can use it as a launching pad for other people's careers. I mean, you said Dan Trachtenberg could have made this movie, but JJ got it seen. But now next time Dan Trachtenberg gets to make his movie and gets a bit more credit, you know? And I think that's just kind of getting a foot in the door. And I think that's helpful. I think he is more willing to contribute are more willing to recognize the contributions of others than people are. I just think he's such, you know, he's a celebrity director and he's got a look to him, and he was in a Lonely Island video, and he, you know, presents things and he speaks really well in interviews, and
he speaks so well.
Yeah, I know you're gonna do that. I just think that he's such a good visible person, and he's so comfortable on camera, it seems, and he's funny and he's smart and he's charismatic. And I think it gets more people. He's more relatable and more memorable than other directors or producers are. And I think I think that works well for him. And I think that works well for others. I think he works with his friends a lot. I think people like working with him. And I do think he's pretty hands-on and has a lot to do with these projects. Not as much as everyone seems to think, but I do think that he's involved. And just thinking about the future of the Cloverfield universe, franchise, Cloververse, whatever. You know, it was silly when people were throwing around the word, you know, Christopher Nolan was godfathering Man of Steel, or some of the ways that directors get tied to movies they're not directing and sometimes not even producing, just to have their name attached to it in a more meaningful way. And I think we're going to see that a lot with him in the future. And the way that this anthology franchise is shaping up, you know, it sounds so pretentious, but he's curating this anthology, I think, is the way this is going to work out. And just like anthologies, it's going to mean that these projects they fit within a certain stream. And with Cloverfield Lane, people keep saying that it shares the same DNA, or that it's a blood relative. And there's kind of this organic addiction that comes along with it. And I think that's valuable. And I think it's a good way to create an anthology, is to kind of have someone to point to that you can say, this is a J.J. Abrams kind of movie, even if it's not a J.J. Abrams movie. It's clever. It's a bit off kilter. It's going to be kind of original and quirky, but funny and dark and cool, you know? And I understand your why you would feel bad about these people getting kind of the short shrift. And I do, I honestly do too. And I think that how many people have said J.J. Abrams and not said Dan Trachtenberg?
I mean, the number of times we have today.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I just think that it's part of it. And I think overall, it's probably a positive effect. And that's why I don't feel as bad, because I think he's good to the people that he works with, which is why I don't care as much.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree. And a lot of the problem is not of JJ's own doing, you know. It's just that most people's strongest exposure to a movie is the advertising, and an advertising's job is to sell you something, and in order to sell you this movie, JJ Abrams was a really helpful name to have on the trailer, you know?
And he's got a really good track record. I didn't see Lost, Alias, whatever, but just
I didn't see any of the things we're talking about here today.
No, but he's just got a good track record, and until he Shyamalans, like it's gonna stay this way. And yeah. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I totally see you know, the ostensible downsides to it, but as a business, and the fact that I hear that he's a decent human being, I don't think it's as bad as it could be with other people.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an Alfred Hitchcock Presents sort of thing, is the way Cloverfield is going.
Yeah, and I liked those when I was young. And listen to the Black Mirror podcast if you want to hear me talk about how good anthologies can be. And it'll build this little universe that keep some of the good things about the cinematic universes that exist and will drop a lot of the bad things. And, you know, people say, Howard worked for the Navy, and we see the paperwork from the satellite company. That's the same one from the first one, and all those cool little tie-ins. And those will continue to grow. And I think by the time we get the fourth or fifth one, there's going to be one really funny joke about the way that those tie in. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to be kind of this rich tapestry of movies. But I don't think it's going to be like Marvel, where they go, okay, for toy sales, we've got to have 7 new people and 4 new vehicles, and we need to tie into this. And this movie's coming out next year, so we need to save 15 minutes to build up this character. I think those things that people dislike about franchises are going to be absent. And, you know, I think J.J. Abrams has a lot to do with that. And I like that. You know, that's fine with me. And I really like anthologies when done well. And from what I've seen, he seems to do them well.
Okay, cool.
Sweet.
So let's talk about, I think the theme throughout this movie that I think kind of ties into Cloverfield, at least from, you know, the perspective of the characters that we are following. In, as I said, in Cloverfield, it's the, you know, forget the world and hang on to the people that you care about the most, right? At the beginning of 10 Cloverfield Lane, Michelle, you know, she has an argument with Ben and runs away from their home. And that's what sets a big chunk of this movie apart. And there's so much talk about throughout the movie about specifically the girl in the hardware store story, where people talk about wishing they had done more in their life, because they're now in a bunker and they assume that they will be there for the rest of their life. You know, yeah. Emmett has his story about not catching the bus because he's afraid of doing something
so fast I could run away from my bad grades.
Yeah. And Michelle has the story about seeing a father abuse his daughter in a hardware store, and her tying that to her own physical abuse as a child, and wishing she had done something but never actually did. And this whole movie ends up being about her deciding to do something about it, right? And you know, she's, even at the beginning of the movie, like I said, she's still instead of, you know, fighting through a problem, she is running away from it. The fight she had with Ben, which was not physical, or we're never led to believe it was, but you know, and then towards the end of the movie, she actually finally does fight back against Howard and get out, and then she immediately has to start fighting back against aliens, monsters, whatever they are. And and I thought that was cool, and I thought that was a good through line in this movie. And then it really they really hit the nail with you know, they really kind of fucking nail it at the end. Sorry, when she decides whether or not she's going to go to safety in Baton Rouge or go help out in Houston. Yeah. And I think what she has figured out throughout the movie is that running from problems isn't great. She should head at them head on, and so she turns to Houston. You know, and I thought that was something that was, you know, is like almost a tad overdone from time to time, but at least it gave
the literal fork in the road decision.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At least it gave a reason, or sorry, at least it gave sort of like this human sort of touch to the movie, you know, like these things that Michelle wished she didn't do, and then her not having regrets about the things she did do in the bunker, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have a reading on that. Well, it ties into my reading of Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Cloverfield was the first, you know, I think memorable post 9/11 New York disaster movie, right?
Yeah.
I can't think of another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was... They did not shy away from the fact that this was taking place in New York. I mean, the Statue of Liberty's head on the poster and in one of the iconic scenes, and Brooklyn Bridge in Manhattan.
Yeah, I have a book called Hollywood 9/11, and the cover of the book is the poster of Cloverfield. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's such a cool, iconic image from Escape from New York. But yeah, I think the Cloverfield, the first one, is it's about loss. And, you know, I think it's important that at the end they die in the way that, you know, versus the way that 10 Cloverfield Lane ends, where our protagonist lives to see another day. It's about loss, and it's, you know, the things that, you know, what could have been. And that's what it is with Rob and Beth. They were platonic friends forever, and then they slept together a month ago, and then this night happens, and, you know, she brings Travis. And I think that's, you know, that storyline is so important, and that's why we get it at the start, at the end, and little bits sprinkled in between. And they go and they try to save her. And with their death, I mean, they lose this whole life together that they could have experienced. And yeah, under the bridge or Greyshot Arch, they finally get to say they love each other, but it's too late. I mean, it's sweet, but it's too late. And there's a palpable sense of what could have been is definitely not going to be any longer. And, you know, to tie that into 9/11, I mean, it was a loss. A lot of people lost their lives, and there's a lot of things they won't experience, and a lot of the things that we won't experience with them, you know, the people who survived. And that's gone. And that's why it's such a bleak ending, is that we lost that. It was just, it's a cool movie, but it's a great story. And these people did have something real with each other, but it's over. And then we go to 10 Cloverfield Lane, and Cloverfield was almost seven years after, years after 9/11. So it's a post 9/11 movie, but it's, to me, it's a 9/11 movie. And I don't think that's a crazy statement.
No, not at all. It's I think that from pre-production, they were like, let's make especially the scene where they walk out in the dust, like, nothing has made me think more about 9/11 than that scene, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, watching buildings being destroyed from the top of another building, and you hear so many people, that was their experience on 9/11, and having no idea what they're doing and running away and getting little bits of information over TV. So it's a 9/11 movie to me. And it was weird, because people, there's that time when it was, are we okay with watching New York be destroyed? Can we take down a skyscraper in a movie set in New York? Is that okay yet? And it was a legitimate question to be asking.
Well, and there was questions being asked about whether or not action movies were okay anymore. You know, like, this is immediately post 9/11, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, even by 2008, there was still a question. I remember, you know, people talking about it on the news and things like that, and it was kind of a bit of a hallmark of how far we've come. So it's very wrapped up in 9/11, and I think that was a very conscious decision. And I think that for people of a certain age, there's no way to watch Cloverfield and not have those feelings come up in a powerful way.
Yeah.
And so then we get to 10 Cloverfield Lane, and that's a movie about fear and paranoia. And, you know, Howard's a big part of that. And, I mean, the sense of how bad the world is and how bad the things up there are. And Howard has this very strong sense of wanting to go back. You know, the idea that he's lost his wife and his daughter left, and he wants them back. And maybe he's going to take Michelle as his new daughter and try to assemble his family back together. And there's just some things that you can't undo. And, you know, losing a family member, losing someone in 9/11 or whatever tragedy is one of those things that can't be undone. And I remember learning that after 9/11, things like home and garden television and a lot of these kind of home-oriented domestic things were really on the rise and had great ratings and, you know, made a lot more money than they used to. And I think that's what we get with Howard's house. You know, it's just kind of this 90s sitcom-y friendly place, nothing too recent, and it's just homely. And I know part of that is that it's a bunker and not a cutting edge, you know, rich person's home. But I think that's, you know, his desire to go back, I think, shows up a lot in what his place looks like. And he's got this very paternalistic father's knows best kind of mentality, where he's protecting his daughter from the bad world that's out there. And as I said, in a way that's kind of noble, but he's not really sure what's going on out there. He's not willing to go figure it out the way that Michelle is willing to build a gas mask and go see what's out there. I mean, part of it is to escape, but he seems a bit more content to just be down there for a while and rebuild his family, more so than I think would be natural. Just the way he never explains to her, this is what's happening. This is how I know what's happening. This is how I know that we can't go back up there. He doesn't have gas masks, which seems like something you would put in a bunker. That if you ever want to live outside of that bunker again, you would put in a gas mask. But he doesn't want to go out. He wants to stay in there and maintain this. I think his mentality about the bunker is that I've got this place where we can go back to how it was before. And Michelle wants no part of it. Her reaction by the end of things isn't to hide away from the world. It's not even just to run away. It's to go and help. And that's what we get at the end when she ends up going to, you know, making the choice to help instead of run and be saved. And the plot line of this movie is that there's monsters come in many forms. Is that it?
Tagline?
Sorry, yeah, the tagline. Yeah, and I mean, that's said. And I think, you know, to go with the 9/11 reading of these two things, it's there are several kinds of monsters. There are monsters who commit heinous acts against us, and there are monsters who use what's happened for their own self-interests. And I think a political reading of it is, you know, for wars over resources and to roll back civil liberties and war profiteering and all that kind of stuff. And I think in this one, it's for him to take something bad, which really did happen. You know, there are aliens up there. And it is a bad, ugly place up there. But the reaction isn't to just, you know, live in the past. It's to accept what it is and to move on. And that's why I think the first Cloverfield is really simplistic but emotional in a powerful way. But in a very base emotional way, just to, you know, as you said, forget the world and stay with the people you love or care about the people you love. Whereas I think 10 Cloverfield Lane is just a lot more cerebral and interesting. And I think it lends itself more to thinking about after the fact, as I said earlier. And, you know, the first one is very urban and modern. It takes place in the city, whereas the second one is very rural and it's about you know, going back to a more idyllic time. And I think it's important that at the end of the second one, she goes to a city. You know, she doesn't go into a field or a farm where she might be away from everybody. She goes into the city and, you know, accepts modernity, that things are bad, but the route to a better life isn't by going backwards and hiding in a false past, but going forward and going forward with intelligence and bravery and compassion and all the things she proves that she has when she tries to protect Emmett and when she fights off the aliens so well, and the way that in the end she chooses to help other people than be saved. It's kind of a more societal concern is the way she thinks, whereas Howard kind of had a more selfish, very dishonest way of living. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And it a lot of what you just said applies to how I feel about 10 Cloverfield Lane. Like, and I think you are right. Everything you've said makes sense to me. I also look at 10 Cloverfield as a 9/11 movie. We agree 100% there. And I look at 10 Cloverfield Lane as a Katrina movie, just because of the placement of where the movie exists. You know, like she gets out of New Orleans and eventually goes to Houston, where there was a lot of overflow of evacuees in the Astrodome specifically. And, you know, a lot of what you're saying is just hiding from these monsters that come in all forms, but nature's a monster of its own in its own right, right?
Yep.
So I think that certainly is a reading that shouldn't be ignored, especially since Cloverfield 1 is such a specifically 9/11 movie. I think that they knew
about a specific disaster.
Yeah, exactly. And then Cloverfield Lane is also about a specific disaster, you know, less so, but certainly you could see Katrina motivating all of these things, you know? And I don't know. I think it's interesting to think about it as a Katrina movie as well.
Yeah, I had considered that, but yeah, definitely with the place of Louisiana and Houston, that lines up perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. And Lake Charles wasn't really hit. I mean, it was hit by Hurricane Rita shortly after Hurricane Katrina, pretty bad, but you know,
and the worst place to be in 10 Cloverfield Lane is low down in a concrete
exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I just thought that bore bringing up, I suppose.
I like it.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about a thing that we'll be talking about.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.